You know, this is a small population state. We can raise enough money to win. Nobody knew who Joe Miller was on the 31st of May.
Scott McAdams ramps up his campaign to win a U.S. Senate seat. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 1st of September. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a look at how Joe Miller came from 30 points behind to win the primary.
I don't think there were a lot of people who really thought that Joe Miller would mount that close of a challenge, even right up until the end.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The national group that works to get Republicans elected to the Senate is congratulating Joe Miller on his win in the primary. The National Republican Senatorial Committee put out a statement last night applauding Miller as its nominee and pledging its support. Just days ago, Miller was accusing the NRSC of what he called meddling in the campaign on Murkowski's behalf. But now that he's the presumed nominee, NRSC spokesman Brian Walsh says his group is willing to help Miller with staff and funds, but they'll wait to see if he requests it.
If he needs our help, we will be happy to provide it. But he just ran a great campaign, and frankly, the ball's in the Democrats' court. They are on defense in 12 Democratic-held states right now, and that's before we even get to a state like Alaska. So I think it remains to be seen whether the Democrats are going to be behind their own candidate, but certainly we're making clear that if he needs our help, he'll have it.
The national group that helps Democrats get elected to the Senate says it believes Scott McAdams is a strong candidate, but it would not say whether it plans to send money and support staff up to Alaska. A spokeswoman for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee says it never talks about fundraising strategy. The DSCC would not go on tape with APRN about the Senate race or its level of support for McAdams. Senator Mark Begich says he fully plans to ask the DSCC and others to get involved and to contribute to the McAdams effort.
Oh, I'm going to be asking. You bet you I'm going to be asking. And I think there's no question in my mind of all the races around the country, this is one of them that they should put on a high priority.
Begich says he thinks the race is wide open and will likely be tightly contested in the end.
Joe Miller, an Ivy League lawyer who's really run a national kind of campaign rather than a Alaska campaign. Then you have Scott McAdams, who's a mayor. Of course, I'm biased about mayors. I think they understand the how to balance the budget, how to deal with budget reductions and deal with Republicans and Democrats and solve problems.
Begich says that since McAdams won the Democratic primary last week, his campaign has garnered tens of thousands of dollars in donations from Alaskans. The first poll taken after Senator Lisa Murkowski conceded the race to Joe Miller shows a tight race between Miller and McAdams. Rasmussen Reports surveyed 500 likely voters on the phone just hours after Murkowski conceded the GOP primary to Miller last night. It shows Miller just 6 points ahead of McAdams, 50 to 44. 2% of those surveyed are undecided, and 4% said they had supported a different candidate. KCAW's Ed Ronco spoke to McAdams a few hours before Murkowski's concession about the campaign ahead.
Scott McAdams spent elementary and middle school in Petersburg and Ketchikan, attended high school in California, and then returned to Alaska at age 20. He spent a summer working at a cannery butchering crab, then several years as a deckhand on a commercial fishing vessel. At 27, he decided to return to college and earned a degree in secondary education from Sitka's Sheldon Jackson College in 2000. He served on the school board in Sitka for 3 years and has been mayor of the city and borough of Sitka since 2008.
Sitka is a great little town. It's a great place to live. But we're 164 small towns in this state, even Anchorage.
And becoming known in those 164 small towns is job number one for a campaign facing Joe Miller, whose unexpected success against Murkowski in the primary, as well as support from the Tea Party Express and from former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, have earned him national exposure already. McAdams spent the primary season as a weekend candidate, traveling the state during his off hours. He's now taken a 2-month unpaid leave from his job as director of community schools for the Sitka School District.
Well, you know, we have 2 months left to go, and we will raise that kind of money to be able to have a competitive campaign here in the state with a full media buy and all of the things that come with a campaign, and we will win in November.
As of August 4th, federal reports showed Miller's campaign with about $283,000 in contributions, with more than two-thirds of that spent. The Tea Party Express also has spent roughly $115,000 supporting Miller separately. McAdams' numbers were last updated at the end of June and show nearly $9,200 in contributions, with about half of that spent. But in the week since the election, the website actblue.com shows more than $45,000 in contributions to McAdams. It remains to be seen whether McAdams will receive support from the Democratic National Committee or the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. McAdams says it doesn't matter.
The DSCC and the National Democratic Party doesn't even know what my name is, and you know, that's fine by me. I love the Alaskan Democratic Party. They've been behind me 100%. Senator Mark Begich has been behind me 100%, and that's just fine by me.
But wouldn't the support of those two organizations make a big difference?
Well, I mean, and certainly, you know, I'm not sure exactly what their strategy is going to be. I'm not sure what their plan is. But, you know, this is a small population state. We can raise enough money to win. And, you know, Joe Miller was down. Nobody knew who Joe Miller was on the 31st of May.
McAdams polled 32 points behind Murkowski compared to 8 points behind Miller. That's based on a report from Public Policy Polling, which talked to roughly 1,300 likely voters on August 27th and 28th. McAdams says those numbers give him hope, especially considering Miller's widespread exposure so far.
He's been in front and center in the Alaskan media for the last 5 weeks to the tune of $700,000. We haven't spent any money on media, and the fact that we're only 7 or 8 points down tells me that we're perfectly positioned to peak at the right time and win this election.
Miller and McAdams will appear on the November 2nd ballot for U.S. Senator along with Libertarian Frederick Haas. In Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And a quick clarification, Scott McAdams served 3 years as chairman of the Sitka School Board. Joe Miller hit the ground running today with a flurry of national media interviews as he moves on to the general election. Miller says he's gratified to be the Republican candidate.
We're obviously honored by the choice of the Alaskan people, and also want to give full credit to Senator Murkowski for her honorable concession. Look forward to working together with folk across the state to advancing this campaign and advancing Alaska.
Miller credits many supporters with helping secure the primary win.
You know, we had the endorsement of Governor Huckabee, Governor Palin, Lieutenant Governor Lauren Lehman, Senator Coghill, Senator Dyson, Representative Keller, Representative Wilson. I mean, the list is just goes on and on. But really, at the base of it, my wife for allowing me to do it, my family for putting up with it, as well as, of course, all the volunteers that made this thing happen. You know, when you're running up against, you know, a very well-established campaign like we did, it's really a testament to the volunteer effort that we were able to do this. And we're, again, just incredibly honored and thankful for the folks that were behind us.
Miller says he believes he'll be able to raise the money needed to fund the general election campaign against Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Scott McAdams of Sitka. He says he hasn't talked to the Tea Party Express about additional support. The Express poured a lot of money into the primary, but Miller says he doesn't expect the national group to be involved in the general election. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, bird species are returning to Rat Island after a successful campaign to rid the island of its namesake.
Bird species are much more abundant than we've ever seen them on the island before.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
In late July, Ivan Moore Research found Joe Miller polling more than 30 points behind incumbent Lisa Murkowski. At the time, Moore told APRN it didn't look like Miller could even get close to Murkowski in the primary with numbers like that. But what a difference a few weeks makes. Moore says a number of factors led to Miller's surprise win, including the type of primary in Alaska.
I think this is the end result of the closed primary system that was put in place by the Republicans a while ago that closes the Republican ballot to just Republicans and N's and U's who choose that ballot. What we have is a situation where that leads to the successful election of people who are not as moderate, who are more extreme in their views.
That was a fairly small percentage of Alaskan voters. How does this primary translate to the November election?
Well, it's a whole different kettle of fish in November. Not only do you get all the Democrats and the Libertarians and the Alaska Independents coming into the room, you also get all the nonpartisans and the undeclareds who didn't pick the Republican ballot. But perhaps even more important than that, you've got a tremendous skewing in primary elections. You get people who are more inclined to be primary voters than others. There are people who turn out very regularly for primary elections. Primary voters tend to be more affiliated with the actual parties and consider selection of a candidate in a primary to be more their responsibility. And then the other thing, of course, was the existence of Prop 2 on the ballot, which was the parental notification, which brought out, I'm pretty sure, I don't have any facts to back this up, but I think it was fairly clear that Prop 2 motivated on the yes side of the spectrum, the vast majority of whom were Joe Miller supporters, brought them out, you know, to the point where the profile of people who voted in the Republican primary, both demographically and ideologically, was nothing like the profile of what we'll see in the general election. And I think the danger that Joe Miller runs right now is that while he succeeded in the primary, he may have put himself in a situation where he's not palatable to the people that show up in November. What will happen, we'll just have to wait and see. One thing's for sure is that only in Alaska can stuff like this happen.
You mentioned in the Anchorage Daily News online article that Lisa Murkowski really didn't do a good job in painting a picture for the voters of who Joe Miller really is. Why not? Why do you think she didn't do that?
It's the heartburn that a lot of candidates have for engaging in negative campaigning. When you've got a situation where you're being attacked by an opponent, some candidates have this feeling that taking the high road is the way to go. And I think Lisa specifically used those words, that she was taking the high road. I think there was a certain amount of overconfidence and a certain amount of not taking the threat of Joe Miller seriously. Probably up until the last days, anyway, probably thought that winning in the primary was going to be a bit of a breeze. And, you know, I think generally speaking, in Lisa's defense, I can understand how that happened. I don't think there were a lot of people who really thought that Joe Miller would mount that close of a challenge, even right up until the end. Lisa, starting off as someone who was viewed pretty positively and who had $2.4 million in the bank, by all accounts, should never have put herself in a situation where, come primary day, she was uncertain about what the result was going to be. And the blame for that has got to fall squarely on her campaign.
Ivan Moore is a pollster in Anchorage. An Alyeska report on May's oil spill at Pump Station 9 sheds light on its cause and raises concerns about pipeline operations. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The technical failure analysis has been kept confidential by the company, but a redacted copy was released by the Joint Pipeline Office at the request of industry critic Richard Feinberg. Alyeska has said the May incident resulted when a backup system or uninterrupted power supply failed during a fire drill. Feinberg says the report confirms that and points to previous trouble with a similar unit at Pump Station 3.
These are complex causal issues. They need to be crystal clear on what they're doing. And having had the warning from a different pump station that the UPS is finicky, they should have done better preparation for the shutdown. That's really clear.
Feinberg says the report blames the backup power distribution unit's failure on a circuit breaker that tripped.
And they focused on that as a possible reason, but they still couldn't find out why the breaker tripped.
Without power, Pipeline Pump Station 9 valves opened and let oil flow into a massive relief tank, a design feature that prevents potential overpressure of the line during a pump station shutdown. Feinberg says that's standard procedure, and it's unclear why the tank was allowed to overflow.
It's almost incomprehensible to me that the operations control people, let alone the maintenance people at Pump Station 9, both of them couldn't figure out that when the power went out, that meant the valves would open. That's automatic. Neither party recognized it until 40 minutes later, it started overflowing the tank, and because there were maintenance people there doing maintenance, somebody saw it.
The valves were shut and all the spillover oil was caught in a line containment area and recovered. Alyeska Corporate Communications Director Michelle Egan acknowledges that pipeline staff were distracted by the power problem and failed to realize the storage tank would overflow. Egan says Alyeska has already taken actions to raise situational awareness.
We now have a system where people who are working at the operations control center and at pump stations have to have a consciousness and awareness of the entire system. And again, we're calling it situational awareness. And there's some very specific training that we can give around that, and we've started that already.
Egan says engineers have not been able to figure out why the PS9 breaker tripped and kept the UPS unit from distributing generator power, but adds that Alyeska has made some changes to address it.
One is changing the command sequence to what happens with valves and whatnot when the station needs to be protected in a situation like that. And then the second significant technical change is reconfiguring how power is distributed to the UPS system. And that will circumvent the problem.
Egan says the May incident was specific to a shutdown environment, and the scenario could not play out if there was a power failure during normal operating conditions, something Feinberg questions. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta's native corporation, Calista, has put its longtime president on administrative leave because of a sexual harassment lawsuit against him from member station KYUK in Bethel. Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The decision to put Matthew Nicolai on leave was made by the corporation's board of directors on Friday, and media was notified on Tuesday. Nicolai has been president for the last 15 years and has worked for Calista since 1975. He's originally from the village of Kweethluk, about 15 miles upriver of Bethel on the Kuskokwim. The board has put Vice President Andrew Guy in Nicolai's place. Lincoln Garrick is Calista's director of communications. He said it was a personal matter.
Through this course of actions, we've kind of allowed some breathing space for this personal matter to resolve as it will.
Nicolai is being taken to court by an employee who is alleging that they had an affair and he later became a stalker and prevented her from doing her job. Garrick stresses that Calista is not named as a defendant in the case.
The complaint is not against Calista Corporation. The complaint is against an individual.
He says Andrew Guy will be the acting president until the board decides otherwise. Guy is from Nebuskiak, which is about 5 miles from Bethel, and has been with Calista since 1996 as the executive vice president and general counsel. Calista is the second largest native corporation in the state. Its region encompasses over 6.5 million acres and includes 56 villages. Calista represents over 13,000 shareholders. Nicolai was paid over $730,000 as corporation president for 2009. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
A memorial service has been scheduled for the Hoonah police officers killed last weekend in what authorities say was an ambush by a lone gunman. Interim City Administrator Bob Prunella says officers Tony Wallace and Matt Tokioka will be honored in a ceremony next Wednesday at 2 p.m. in the Hoonah High School gym. Prunella says he's heard the memorial will be attended by law enforcement personnel from across the country. The suspect in the police shootings, 45-year-old John Marvin Jr., was arraigned in Juneau yesterday.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Fall semester starts September 2nd. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
All of the rats on Rat Island in the Aleutian Islands have been killed as part of a large habitat restoration project. KDLG student reporter Sam Wright has the story.
The report that the rats are gone is good news to Steve McLean. He's a conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy in Alaska, which was part of the 2008 project to get rid of the invasive rats on Rat Island that were devastating local seabird populations.
So it leads us to think that perhaps we can tackle some of the other Aleutians as well. The other islands are larger. It's going to be a little bit more complicated. But we think that with these techniques and what we've learned from these from the Rat Island project, that we can then start thinking about other projects in the Aleutians as well.
The project to get rid of the rats on Rat Island was in the planning stage for 4 years before it got started in 2008, when a team spread grain-based bait pellets across the island from helicopters. After 2 years of monitoring, a team of biologists reported on Monday that the island is now free of rats, which McLean says were introduced by a shipwreck.
In about 1780, a vessel went aground on Rat Island and had some unintended guests that made their way to the island. And none of the others are still there, but the rats, that's all it took, was just one shipwreck with a few rats. And by the middle of the 1800s, the island was so overrun by rats that a Russian captain went ashore. To get water for his ship, and was so disgusted by all of the rats on the island that he named it Rat Island.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been working to get rid of invasive species in the Aleutian Islands for years, and so far, non-native foxes have been removed from 40 islands, including Rat Island. McLean says a move is now underway to come up with a new name for the island.
And we've asked our partners at the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association to work with their members and their groups and the elders to consider a new name for Rat Island.
The goal behind the rat eradication effort on Rat Island was to allow the natural ecosystem to once again begin to flourish. McLean says they've already started to see some bird species nesting on the island they have not seen before.
Other bird species are much more abundant than we've ever seen them on the island before. But we're going to give them a couple of years to see if some of the other burrow nesting seabirds start to come back in higher numbers. And just hopefully let the Aleutian system take care of Rat Island and return it to a natural system.
The giant song sparrow, which is only found in the central and western Aleutian Islands, is now commonly found on Rat Island. Other species that are expected to benefit include black oyster catchers, rock sandpipers, red-faced cormorants, and gray-crowned rosy finches. Rat Island is just 10 square miles in size, and the rat eradication project was led by a group called the Island Conservation. In Dillingham, I'm Sam Wright.
Three brown bear cubs captured in Sitka this August will remain in town indefinitely. Officials with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game report that several out-of-state zoos initially interested in the cubs have found bears elsewhere. Sitka's Fortress of the Bear is making arrangements with the state to house the bears permanently. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The cubs were captured in a so-called dead man trap at the Fortress of the Bear on August 19th. Fortress personnel had set the trap, a gate that automatically closes behind the bears after they enter a vacant habitat, in the hope of giving state biologists the chance to radio collar an unrelated sow that also had been visiting Sitka. When the cubs were trapped unaccompanied by their mother, biologists realized she was likely dead. They found the carcass by tracking the bear's radio collar signal. Her cause of death has not been determined. At the time, officials were optimistic that the cubs, who had been painted 12, 13, and 14 when their mother was collared, would be placed as a family in a zoo in the lower 48. ADF&G biologist Phil Mooney says, like adoptions anywhere, things have changed.
As of yesterday, the Louisville Zoo was looking to get three cubs, and they have picked those up from Montana, so they're no longer in need. And the Tulsa Zoo was also looking 2 to 3 cubs, and they're looking for more of Cubs of the Year.
Cubs of the Year refers to cubs born this spring. The 3 cubs successfully transferred to the Bronx Zoo last year from Sitka were Cubs of the Year. They were still under 100 pounds when they were shipped out last summer. 12, 13, and 14 were Cubs of the Year last year. They already weigh 150 pounds each now. Mooney says it's an order of magnitude more difficult to ship larger cubs.
You can't just stick those yearlings in a, say, a dog kennel and send them down there. So that does get to be an issue. And even the Bronx Zoo, when they transferred those last year, sent in specially designed cages, each one in one, and then there was a matter of some time for Fortress of the Bear crate trained those bears so that they felt comfortable for that long trip.
Co-director Evie Kinnear says the fortress, which currently holds a temporary permit for the cubs, will apply to house them long term, though she doesn't rule out the possibility of finding other homes. Kinnear says the fortress habitat can easily accommodate the cubs. However, the facility is going to have to move ahead with plans to expand its holding cages if it is to hold more rescued bears in the future. Phil Mooney agrees. He says ADF&G always understood that at some point the fortress would reach capacity and the department would be left without a facility to place orphaned cubs. Not that all cubs will get that chance, however. Mooney says 2 yearling brown bears orphaned in May in Sitka were beyond rescue. They had become exceptionally bold and dangerous, and ADF&G was consulting with outside experts on the possibility of destroying the male cub on the chance that the sow and female cub would return to a more natural behavior away from town. When a resident shot the sow, Mooney says the dynamic shifted in favor of also shooting the cubs.
The male cub was already on death row, if you want to put it like that. He was already on run out of number of chances, and so when they're both left like that, it wasn't a good situation. We weren't in a position to capture the cubs right away, and the sow had been dead for at least 24 hours, and they're not going to stick around very long. And then you've already got 2 cubs running around, and the little female is going to follow the male, and they're going to end up on somebody's porch at night, and we're going to go through a much worse situation of trying to either get them or put them down.
Mooney says putting cubs down is the last thing he wants to do. At a meeting of department officials and the fortress last week, euthanizing 12, 13, and 14 was taken off the table. Mooney says the task now is working with the cubs to get them accustomed to people and the facility, which could become their permanent home. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. Follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Sam Wright in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Federal Housing Administration's network of FHA-approved housing counseling agencies offers free expert advice to homeowners whose mortgages are at risk, underwater, or in need of refinancing. Visit hud.gov/Alaska for a counselor near you. This message sponsored by HUD.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.